Hi, and welcome back to another episode of Occupy Interview. We are the Occupy America Social Network. We've got a lot of things, a lot of lies to try to get knocked down today, and we've only got an hour to do it. The title of this show is episode 32, Robbing Cowboys and Indians. And I'm going to go ahead and let my guests introduce themselves. Mac, you're not allowed to say this anymore, so I hope I don't get in as much trouble as you did. But ladies first, Ramona, could you introduce everybody and kind of let them introduce themselves?
Sure. I'll introduce myself first, and I'm Ramona Hage Morrison out of Reno, Nevada. My family has been involved in a long-time lawsuit in two different courts involving federal land matters, very similar to the recent Bundy situation. We have prevailed in almost every step of the way, and I also currently sit on the Nevada Board of Agriculture, the Department of Agriculture in charge of brand inspection certificates. And so we had some involvement in the situation down in Bunkerville last week. And on that note, Sheriff Mack, would you like to introduce yourself?
No, you go ahead. Well, Ramona's one of my new bestest friends in the whole world, and I've known her family for a long time and followed what her dad was doing to stand for freedom, and now stand with her in standing with the Bundys. And this whole thing to me is just a freedom issue. It's a constitutional issue. And when you get down to the principles involved there, it's the pursuit of happiness that we should all be protecting regarding Clive Bundy and his family. And I'm a former sheriff. I'm a former cop. I'm a former detective and a former patrol officer. And I'm a former litigant against the Clinton administration. And I'm one of seven sheriffs that have sued the federal government, took a case all the way to the United States Supreme Court and won. And actually, there was only two of us at that time that ended up at the Supreme Court, but there were seven of us in that battle. And I started that battle back in 1994, and that's why I crossed paths with the Bundys and the Hages. And I'll continue to stand with anybody in this country that's fighting the Goliath federal government that is hell-bent on destroying our ranching industry in this country.
That's wonderful. I'd like to also introduce Raymond Yao, the former chief of the Western Shoshone Nation, which encompasses a good portion of the West. And I want to just say from a personal point of view, Raymond has been a close friend of my family's for a very long time. And he represents a part of this story that cannot be forgotten, because the raids that we've seen on the Bundy place happened to Raymond himself, and happened to the Dan sisters, who happened to also be his cousins. And I just want to open it up with that. Raymond, you can add on to that, but as a dear friend, I'd like to introduce you.
Yeah, that's okay.
Well, we want to dedicate this show to Mary Dan. I am sorry I never got a chance to meet her. Like everybody I'm talking to take a stand against the entire United States government, that takes a lot of guts. Mac, you're a peacemaker. That's about as gutsy as it gets. And I'd just like to go ahead and get started with the Dan story, if we could. One of the lies going around is that this is not something that people should be thinking about, because it's only a rich white man story, and obviously that's not true. Could you guys please tell us about the Dan sisters?
Well, the easiest thing I know there is that they're not white.
Raymond, would you like to tell about your cousins, please? And I can go in from the from what happened in the raid, because I was covering that, but I would like you to share about your cousins.
Well, it's quite a long story. I'll do try to shorten it up as best as I can. The Dan sisters kind of took it upon themselves way back in the 1970s to see or try to find out how the United States acquired the territory of the Washoe Nation. Going back to the legal kind of a point of view on that, down to the years, the Western Shoney found out various laws that was made almost from the foundation of the United States of how they would go about taking the lands of Indian nations as they come across from the east to the west. The first thing that they found was the what they called the Northwest Ordinance, and in layman's terms, it said Indian lands will not be taken without their consent. And then following that on down to various other laws, there was a Trade and Intercourse Act passed in 1834. I think that was the last one. Section 11 and Section 12 state that only the United States is to deal with the Indians, and only the United States can authorize trade. And then you get down to the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo with the United States and Mexico, in Article 11, has some pretty iffy language. Something like the lands now being contemplated in the future, in other words, not with that treaty, but in the future, will be within the bounds of the United States, is now occupied by savage Indian tribes. And the lands that were taken by the United States through that treaty, of course, included where the lands that the Western Shoshone were on. And so the language itself says that Mexico did not extinguish the title of the Western Shoshone, you know, per se. And then you get down to the 1861 Nevada Territorial Act, and in making, you know, creating that territory, they refer right back to the 1787 Northwest Ordinance and state that the Indian lands that's within the territory of Nevada will not be included in their territory without their consent. And then from there we go to the 1863 treaty that is one of peace and friendship. There's no language in there about the conveyance of land to the United States. It's one of just peace and friendship. And this is 1863. The Civil War is going on. There's gold in California. There's silver and gold in Carson, in Virginia City. The United States has to have safe passage of about 600 miles of Shoshone territory to get that gold and silver back to the east to support the war effort. And so this is why the treaty was only one of peace and friendship, not of territorial acquisition. And having found that out, the Dan sisters then took it upon themselves to kind of put it up to the United States by not paying their grazing fees or turning cattle out onto their perception of Shoshone land without paying the United States grazing fees, bring it to a head. Unfortunately, the court system is not very favorable to Indian issues. They lost in the district court and was appealed twice to the Ninth Circuit Court. And the last time at the Ninth Circuit Court, that court ruled that payment had not occurred, which the United States claimed it had, and that the title had never been litigated. The United States then appealed that to the Supreme Court, 1983-1984, and that Supreme Court ruled that because a claim had been filed by a government-created Indian entity in the Indian Claims Commission that was completed in 1979, and the Secretary of Interior, being the trustee of their ward, the Dan sisters, accepted the money on their behalf, and therefore payment had been made to the Western Shoshone for their land. And that's how the Supreme Court ruled. And that kind of ended the main Shoshone argument when that came out. But the Dan sisters continued to press because one of the things that the Ninth Circuit said did not get settled or did not get overturned, and that was title had never been litigated. And so they pursued that down on to, 2002, when their cattle was finally seized by the BLM. And it was never determined anywhere in the United States court where the Shoshone title, the Westernry title, had ever been litigated. And that's kind of it in a nutshell.
Can you go ahead and do you see any similarities between the Bundy situation right now and what happened with your cousin?
Yes, very similar in that the impoundment or the gather happened basically with the with a show of force. When they took my cattle and also Carriage cattle, of course they were there with their so-called rangers with their weapons on their hips and other. It wasn't in my case, but in Dan's case, they had in group of, federal officers or federal people from somewhere, from all over the country, kind of keeping people at bay from going in to interrupt the roundup. And, of course, these people were armed with automatic weapons. They didn't use any tasers against any of us. And we didn't have any dogs, that were present in our deal, as was in the Bundy deal. And the similarity goes, like in my case particularly, to Bundy is the ignoring of the rights that people have. And when I say that, I'm referring to the 4th, 5th, and 14th Amendments of the United States Constitution, where the property rights of people have to be taken in a legal manner. There has to be a legal process preceding it. And so that's where my case and the Bundy case kind of connect. Bundy comes from a different perspective, more, I would assume, than what Hage went through. That's what Ramona's father went through. He starts from the settlement of that land down there and the establishment of water rights, establishment of grazing rights, and of course, when those were done, those were stated in as rights, not as privileges, as it's kind of defined today by the BLM. So that's
and again,
kind of the connection I make with the Bundy family.
Did they kill cattle like they did this time?
They didn't any of ours. They didn't any of our cattle, or to my knowledge, any of the Dan cattle.
We got about 6 minutes and 50 seconds before we have to move to the next segment, which is when we'll talk about your family's dealings with it. Is there anything you wanted to add there, Ramona?
Well, the raid on the Dan sisters, I've said for a long time, we're sending men and women over to Iraq and Afghanistan. And yet the press was completely blocked from showing up at that raid. And I said, I told this to an AP reporter. I said, we've got our guys in foreign countries fighting a war, and yet we have our own government personnel conducting a raid on the equivalent of a rape, basically, on two old ladies, very elderly at the time, and committed peace activists. And the disparity was so amazing in that they felt they needed 50 armed agents to come in there and raid those elderly ladies and to gather 200 head of cattle that two men a horseback could have done in a day. And once again, we had a situation in both Raymond's case and in the Dan sister case where the sheriff abdicated his duties. He went missing, just like Sheriff Gillespie did. And that's what's so important about what Sheriff Mack talks about all over the United States with regard to the importance of the sheriff and his oath of office and him taking authority over the police powers that are delegated to him under the Constitution.
I've got about 5 minutes left in this section. Sheriff Mack, can you address that real quickly?
Well, Ramona is absolutely correct, and I'm grateful that I got to meet the Dan sisters at one of the meetings where I met Clive Bundy. And I guess when you're in the West and you're fighting for freedom and state sovereignty, then you're going to end up at some of the same meetings. And I love the Dan sisters. They were great people. And just like I said about the Bundys over and over, these are salt-of-the-earth people. And then we have somebody like Harry Reid, who completely ignores the government's destruction of the ranching industry, completely supports it, and then completely supports his own federal government creating a corral, not just for the cattle that they stole, but for us. We could only have freedom of speech if we were inside their makeshift corral. Can you believe that? In America, the United States of America, we have the most powerful U.S. senator, and all he does is complain afterwards and does nothing to prevent this from happening to citizens in his state. And Harry Reid's right, Clive Bundy was right when he told Harry Reid just to stay out and stay in Washington and mind his own business. But it would have been nice if somebody in Washington had said, you know what, these are federal employees that are attacking this family in Bunkerville, and this is an outrage, and we need to stop it. No, Harry doesn't say anything until it ends peacefully, and then he's all ticked off, calling everybody a terrorist. And, you know, if we're all terrorists, then he has the duty to go and arrest us. And so this is just a bunch of crap from Harry Reid, and that he allows his own federal employees, his own federal government, to put us in a corral and then says, this is the only place you can have freedom of speech. And there were so many laws broken there, assault on the Bundy aunt and threw her down, the tasing and all of this other harassment. And it is just absurd that our federal government has gotten away with this, with the Dans, with the Hages, with Raymond, and destroying all of these ranches. And I cannot believe that somebody there didn't do something about it. And I'm ashamed of this government. And if this is what America is, then I'm ashamed to call myself one.
I'm a Democrat. I have held elected office in my county. And I'm ashamed of my party for not taking the stand. We're the party of Jefferson. This is not a left-right issue. This is not a Democrat-Republican issue.
That's right.
This isn't a Cowboys or Indians issue, obviously.
Yeah.
This is about freedom and slavery. Did they really coerce and threaten and bully like they are doing this time? Read on your local network station is supposedly, again, threatened Bundy and said, something's going to happen, which kind of sounds like something from a mafioso or something more than a United States senator. Was there the level of coercion when it was your cousin and you?
No, there was none of that that went on. They didn't do anything along those lines to either myself or, as far as I know, to the Dans.
Well, they kept the press out of it a lot more effectively back then. I had never heard of the Dan sisters up until 2 days ago, and it came across in a link from the internet, from Anonymous, and I want to thank them for doing the job that the paid media, the corporate media, is supposed to be doing. I'm sorry we didn't help out when it was you guys, and hopefully we do better in the future. We have got to end this standoff before somebody gets hurt. That's what we're trying to do here today, is get some truth out here, get these lies backed off. And I want to thank you guys for standing. It's an act of courage. Welcome to the Occupy movement, guys. Freedom of speech areas has been something we're used to, and I saw one of the funniest signs, because I needed a good laugh after looking at all of this stuff. It's sickening. There was a government sign that said freedom of speech area, and somebody out there had taped up a handwritten sign below it that said freedom of speech is not an area. We'll try to have a link to that picture because
says
a lot.
Maybe it is. The freedom of speech area is the area where my feet are.
Can we quote you on that?
Absolutely.
Okay, we're at we've 39 minutes left, so we're into our next 20-minute segment. Ramona, take off. Do you see any similarities between what happened with your family and with what's going on? And there's a loaded question.
Well, the two cases are very similar in that both ranches had pre-existing rights that have been grandfathered or protected in every land law passed by Congress. And the only difference was Cliven pled his case quite a bit differently than my father pled our cases, and my brother pled the trespass case that we had here recently in federal district court. And but nonetheless, the underlying cases are very similar. But the other thing that's in every land law passed by Congress that a lot of people don't understand is a reservation of civil and criminal jurisdiction to the states. And what I find so troubling about this situation, while technically the government did have in this instance, this is the only time they've had a lawful court order in any one of these raids in Nevada. And as I told somebody a week ago, I said, this isn't our first rodeo in Nevada. We've done these things before. And but this time they had considered a lawful court order, although now, as we see that the BLM is euthanizing tortoises, it might be a court order based on fraud.
Sorry.
But nonetheless, they had a legal way in which to go after those cattle. And in simple terms, they should have got a writ of execution from the clerk. They should have brought that writ to the sheriff. And the sheriff then should have been in charge of any law enforcement activities as the impoundment went forward. The BLM did have the right to gather those cattle, but they didn't have the right to pack sidearms for the purposes of doing anything other than protecting themselves. And they didn't have the right to point snipers at the Bundys. They didn't have the right to run cattle to death. They didn't have pursuant to the court order. They didn't have the right to kill cattle. They didn't have the right to tear out range improvements, which are private property interests of the Bundys. And instead, they certainly didn't have the right to taser people. And so what we see in this Bundy matter is a travesty in terms of a breach of the peace. And we can lay it squarely at the feet of Sheriff Gillespie. Now, for a lot of people, a lot of your people may not know who Sheriff Gillespie is. But he is the sheriff of America's entertainment capital, Las Vegas. He has the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department at his fingertips. He has a SWAT team at his fingertips. I am sure he has had extensive training for terrorism incidents in one of those high-rise casinos. This is a man who has a lot of means at his fingertips, and you mean to tell me that he was incapable, while the BLM gathered cattle, of keeping the peace between the BLM and one Mormon ranching family out of northern Clark County? I find that just completely incongruous. And so instead, though, he completely abdicated his duties, took his hand off the steering wheel. And if the press wanted to call and find out anything about what was going on down there, they got referred to the BLM. And what we had down there in Bunkerville was almost a massacre. We almost had Bunker Hill instead of Bunkerville. And we had Americans pointing guns at each other. And the fact that the sheriff allowed this breach of the peace to occur is a travesty. And I think that forward, is one, an education for the American public to understand that the BLM has no law enforcement authority. There has never been a general grant of law enforcement authority to the BLM or the Forest Service or the Fish and Wildlife Service. We saw the same thing when the Fish and Wildlife Service did the raid on Gibson Guitar Company. They asserted a police power they simply did not have. And if we're not real careful with these federal employees, permanently employed, lifetime employees, they're not elected. If we're not real careful with these guys, We will have a permanent national police force. Nothing like anything that the founders of this nation ever contemplated. And we're on a very slippery slope if we continue to let this happen. So anyway, but as far as Clive and Bundy's underlying case, it's pretty much on point with our case.
And basically, in a nutshell, one of the lies we really need to deal with here is that it's the feds that are breaking the law. It's the people there that are there with the Bundys that are upholding the law. And I don't
well,
think
what
that
we've,
can be said.
What we've seen with these federal agencies, and we've studied it extensively because we've been in litigation with them for 22 years, is that most often what the federal agencies, whether they be the U.S. Forest Service or the BLM, are doing is they're, if they would merely enforce the laws as written, there wouldn't be a lot to complain about, because all of our rights are protected in the laws of Congress and so forth. So if they were merely operating within the bounds of the law, I don't think there would be a whole lot of complaint about these federal agencies. But they have acquired a culture of lawlessness, largely because they're not held accountable. And so they don't really pay close attention to the bounds of the laws that they operate under, and we saw that so clearly with the Bundy case. They said, they sat there with foghorns pointed at the people in that underpass on the I-15 highway, yelling at them, saying, "We're just enforcing a court order." Well, if that's so, I want to know why they aren't so concerned about following court orders that are against them. We, in our case, have a court order for them to give us a grazing permit. We have contempt of court charges laid out against the BLM manager and the Forest Service ranger in our case, in which they're supposed to cough up $30,000. They never have. Why aren't they executing the court order against them in the Joe Fellini case, where they were ordered by the court to gather the wild horses on that range down to herd management levels set by Congress? So these guys are talking out of both sides of their mouth. They're all over the press telling everybody how they just need the law to be followed, and they're just enforcing a court order. But quite frankly, these guys are most often the ones not following the law.
We've got 12 minutes left in this section and a whole bunch of things we need to touch base on to shoot down some more lies. One thing I wanted to try to get across, most people have the good sense not to be farmers or ranchers nowadays, so they probably don't understand a lot of these issues at all. I was a smaller family farmer, definitely not a rich man, as that's being portrayed. They're trying to make ranchers out to be rich people. We basically, here in Indiana, we can put one cow per acre because we have water. Out there, I saw your brother say it takes about 320 acres per cow. Am I in the ballpark on that?
Yes. And in fact, if you look at much of the Southwest especially, the conditions are very similar. It's a desert Southwest. The U.S. government, clear back in the 1860s, designated so much of this land as usable only for the purposes of livestock grazing, and to this day that situation is much the same. Of course, hunting and recreation always go hand in hand with livestock grazing, and in fact in Nevada, had water not been spread and springs developed, we would not have the game that we have today. But as these in the West, these vast rangelands are really still usable for little else besides hunting and livestock grazing. And we're really putting them to the best beneficial use you can put them to. So I think describes the condition out here.
Ray is a, you guys have described him as a really good historian. I'm just a historian. I'm not really good. But could you kind of touch on, before there were white ranchers out there, was this land that was being basically grazed by buffalo, which is just another kind of form of cattle, but a lot tougher to fence?
To my knowledge, there was not very many buffalo in is defined as Western Shoshone country. There were a few, but not very many. the Shoshones were a hunter-gatherer. You know, that was how they subsisted, by hunting not only within the Shoshone territory, but also going into parts of Wyoming and parts of Nebraska to, I think that's where they went to get the buffalo. But other than that, they subsisted on what grew in the land, what grew on the land, and then also what animals or whatever game birds or fish and stuff like that they could take from within their territory. Their life was a continual, kind of like a continual revolution of seeking food. And in the case here where there was snow, back in the old day there was a lot of snow, you know, 3 and 4 feet of snow in this country was nothing unusual. And so
wow.
They would, through the summer when the weather was good, they would accumulate their food and dry it and store it and for the winter's use. And that's how they survived in this country. Now, when the trappers came into this country, one of the first non-Shoshone to come into this country, they didn't know how to live off the land, and that's why they were eating their horses and whatever else they could find. Because they didn't prepare themselves for this country. But the Shoshone, that was their main thing. Food was their main pursuit from the time that they broke the winter camp, and they started on whatever grew first, whatever matured first. And they followed that on around to the complete cycle into the fall. And by the time fall came, they had all of their dried meat and their dried seeds and berries and everything that then they would use through the winter to survive.
As a 21st century rancher, basically the kind of ranching that you're doing, free range is what we call it back here in Indiana, you have to live with the land, you have to stay within the land's limits. You have to be careful not to get too many head out there. You've got to have water. You've got to have grass. Can you guys kind of explain that to our city slicker friends here?
Well, a lot of the country that encompasses Nevada has a lot of short shrubs and other kind of feed that's actually very good feed for livestock, but it's not concentrated in a 160-acre pasture. It's spread out. So these ranches in the West, you know, I made a comment one time on another radio show. By the time we raise livestock off of these rangelands, they're about as au naturel as they can be. In other words, cattle are usually, and sheep, but cattle in particular, run to sustain themselves. You buy cattle or breed cattle so that they can handle the conditions out here. And in a lot of cases, most of us still do most of our work horseback. And so it's about as natural a condition as you can raise cattle in. And furthermore, what we've seen in the West is the BLM and Forest Service has continually eliminated livestock grazing from these rangelands and I would also add shut down timber in the forest. Instead of harvesting timber, we now burn it. And instead of running sheep and cattle, we now burn the rangelands. And so when they're properly managed, and you have to do everything in balance, but when they're usually when the government gets in the middle of it and starts imposing arbitrary management decisions on what ordinarily is a very good use of the land, that's when you see some pretty terrible results. And we've seen it especially in the last 10 years out here in Nevada. We've had massive rangeland fires as a result of probably a lack of livestock grazing.
5 minutes left in this section. There's going to be a link up that shows Mr. Bundy. He's taken a video of a cattle trap that BLM not only put up but left behind and didn't tell anybody it was out there waiting to be sprung. It was still armed. If the cattle had gotten into it, they'd have been trapped in there. And again, for people that don't understand, you got to have grass, you got to have water. What happens to cows when you leave them someplace where they don't have water, guys?
Well, they die.
Same thing happens to you and me.
So this is another one of the lies we really need to kind of touch base on here. They were trying to portray themselves as taking care of the animals, taking care of the turtles. Obviously, that's not what they're doing. In fact, there were reports that a lot of the turtle habitat was actually wrecked by the cattle drives they were doing. Have you guys heard anything on that?
Hey, sorry, I've got to break in. I've got to go. I've got to get to a Tea Party meeting where I'm speaking tonight. And I'll leave you in the good hands of the good mouths and minds of the other people that are on here.
Do you have like 5 minutes left that you could touch base on? You had been out there, and you had been Ben Swan and I had interviewed you on the Nevada resolution.
Mm-hmm.
The Nevada resolution was to try to get sheriffs to do their job.
Yes.
We just interviewed Sheriff Christopher last week.
Yes.
And he was talking about trying to get the sheriff to do his job. Can you really talk about that? That was a very courageous thing.
I think we've covered that subject probably about as much as we need to. Ramona covered it good. I've covered it several times. And plain and simply, if Sheriff Gillespie had just kept his oath of office and exercised proper authority and tried to keep the peace at this incident, none of us would have met. We didn't need to. This wasn't necessary. It would have been nice to have a nice picnic at the Bundys, but this was no picnic. And it was all because, one, the federal government overstepped their boundaries, and two, the county sheriff in Clark County allowed them to. And this is the whole push for the CSPOA. The Constitutional Sheriff Movement is a wake-up call to every sheriff in the country. You simply cannot allow this to occur in your county. You can't allow the federal government to come in and victimize people and tase them and throw them to the ground and kill the cattle in this most inhumane ways and erect these barriers for freedom and liberty and then do nothing about it and act like you don't have any responsibility. And so this is what I've dedicated my life to. And we're going to continue to work this, and I look forward to working with all of you. And with that, I'll bid you all a very friendly and fond adieu.
Thank you for being with us. I couldn't have put this show together without you, Mac, and I appreciate
welcome.
It. Stay safe out there.
Thank you, Sheriff.
We've got about 2 minutes, and actually we have 22 minutes left in the show. What are some more of the things that you guys see that need to be addressed here? Because, quite frankly, we don't understand the West. I'm back here on this side of the Mississippi, and obviously since I can take a cow per acre, you guys are doing something completely different. Can you kind of do you see any changes in the cattle industry since they've now ruled that the feedlots are going to have to be changed because they can't continue feeding antibiotics to the cattle? Do you see any changes? Is that going to help bring back free-range cows? Can you guys address that?
I don't know. Raymond, that'll step in. I know that there's a number of people out west here are very concerned about those regulations. But I would just say this about these regulations coming out of Washington, D.C. in general. They need to be we all have a knee-jerk reaction about them, of course, because they sound very onerous. But so many of these regulations have very little to do with the underlying statute, and especially out of this administration, which doesn't seem to be all that concerned about upholding the law, the rule of law. I believe some of these regulations are subject to challenge in the courts, and I suspect this one is as well.
The rationale behind trying to eliminate some of the antibiotics is it's helping. I think the figure was like 70% of the antibiotics used have been fed to livestock, and it's causing antibiotic-resistant diseases. If you feed the germs antibiotics, the ones that live breed, and before long you have antibiotic resistance. We switched over in 1977 to no more antibiotics unless there was actually one that we thought was going to turn into a downer. But it changes how you have to farm. You have to do what Raymond was kind of talking about, that you have to work with the land. Raymond, do you have any thoughts on that? And the average age of farmers now is over 50. Are we going to be able to teach a new generation a new kind of farming? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's always been a concern to us that there's a lot of farmland and rangeland that's going out of production, mainly around cities where the housing has expanded out onto what used to be farmlands, and we're losing that that production. And I think that we're going to, if that keeps going, we're going to reach a point where we're not going to be able to feed ourselves.
We had talked about Agenda 21, and if you can touch on that real quickly, we've got 19 minutes left in the show. The quality of the food, the range, the free range beef, like you guys were growing. Are you still in the business too, Raymond?
No, I'm not. I'm not in the cattle business anymore. I sold what I was able to accumulate back after the BLM took my cows. I sold them 2 years ago because of the shortness of range as we use it here on the South Fork Indian Reservation. So I'm not in the business anymore. I don't know that much about the feedlot operations. I have heard that that antibiotics were used to some extent. What kind, I'm not really aware of. Our system here on the way we ran the cattle on the Suffolk Reservation was almost like a natural system. We didn't use antibiotics. We vaccinated our calves for certain diseases as they were calves, and we didn't use any growth hormones or anything like that. And then we would sell them to the cattle buyers back early on, and then later on we started selling it to a sale yard where they would go on sale. Now, what happened to them after we sold them, what lots they went to or what was put into them, I have no knowledge. My own inclination, again going to what I might say Shoshone law, is that the Shoshones believe in everything being natural, to be used as it is naturally grown or comes about. And not to mess with what it was created as, not to try to change that. One of the supreme laws in the Shoshone country is that you never exterminate a species, no matter what it is. You always leave some for the future, only take what you can use. And that's kind of the principle that we operated on here with our cattle operation. Whatever grassland was out there that could support the herd, that's what we kept the herd size to. We never let it go beyond what the land would support. And great emphasis on the natural stuff, the natural way of things doing. The cattle kind of take care of themselves. They're out on the range. They eat what they need to eat or what they want to eat. We didn't try to put any artificial, growth hormones, things like that, into the stuff that we raid, and that's pretty much still the way that the other ranchers here do. I'm not a rancher, cattle rancher anymore, but the ones that are still in business, that's the way they run their operation.
So, is the Shoshone Nation as a whole? Do you see the youth being taught how to do what we've just been talking about? I mean, it's not as easy as it sounds. It's not like you just throw some cows out there and let them do their thing. It used to be called animal husbandry. You're married to that herd, especially when you're growing natural beef, because you have to keep an eye on them, keep them moving. Are the kids going to learn how to do this so we can keep getting good meat as opposed to not so good meat?
Well, we hope so here on the Suffolk Reservation that those that are want to be in the cattle business. We hope that that's the way they will do it. We encourage them to keep that practice going.
How about, did you have any thoughts on that, Ramona? And again, Agenda 21, you and I briefly talked about it.
Well, for several years, my brother was able to market his calves as being organic or, you know, natural or whatever they label it these days. And we probably still could. So it's, you know, honestly, when you do the math, it differs when you're in tight conditions and you're in where cattle are in packed in a very tight corral situation, such as in a feedlot, and where you have diseases and the spread of disease breaking out. So I won't speak to that. I'm not in that business. But when you've got cattle out on the range, they're spread out, they're not close to one another, and you have one animal get sick with something, it's not likely to spread. So by the time you vaccinate for some of these diseases, first of all, you always have a little bit of loss from the vaccine itself. And second of all, you've got the cost of vaccine. You've got the cost of handling that calf, especially if you do it more than just the one time at branding and so forth. And you pencil it out, and on many levels, a lot of these vaccines don't make a lot of sense in our situation. And so we're fortunate in that we're able to do it that way and run those cattle as naturally as possible. And what Raymond said, as far as the range goes, you know, we have a desert operation. We don't have a haystack there to feed our cattle in the winter. So if we don't manage the livestock numbers according to the conditions of the range, we'll be out of feed the next year. And so if we're in a drought, you cut back on your numbers, and if you've got feed like we had in 2012, we had a bunch of monsoonal rains come through the desert, southern desert of our ranch, and we had grass on the desert that was as high as a horse's belly. And, by the way, that was the first time that had been seen in generations. But nonetheless, sometimes those conditions arise.
We've got 12 minutes left in the show. And one of the things I saw in the video that you sent me, I believe it was Fox put that out, and it was your brother was walking along a fence line and said one of the things that BLM had been harassing you guys over was one staple, and they were basically wanting they were saying that the cows couldn't trespass and the only way to stop it would be 22 miles of fence. Again, for our city people that don't really understand what 22 miles of fence is really all about. Can you kind of elaborate on what he was talking about? And there will be links to those videos. I thought they did a really good job with that.
Yeah, you know, on this, our outfit, and this is pretty typical of a lot of outfits out in the West, it's 80 miles long and about, in some places, 20 miles wide or 40 miles wide. It's a rangeland about the size of Rhode Island. That same rangeland, though, while it's vast, it carries between 2,500 and 4,000 head of cows, depending on the type of conditions that we have. So it is much different than a Virginia farm or an Illinois farm where cattle can stand in grass up to their belly all year long. But we also have that much fence to maintain. And in this instance, the Forest Service in that year had sent us 40 certified letters and visited the ranch 70 times. This was in 1983. This was in President Reagan's term, who, by the way, was the only president that got this Western thing a little bit. But nonetheless, even he couldn't control his bureaucracy. And so we had the Forest Service just harassing us nonstop with various allegations of wrongdoing out there on the range, and one of the most absurd one was that instance that you referenced wherein they said we had a range improvement that we needed to fix on a fence, and when we found the flag, when Dad sent a guy up on the mountain, of course it took all day to ride that mountain, horseback, and when he finally found the flag they were referencing, it was one missing staple. And that goes to a larger point. everybody's hung up on this grazing permit thing. Same thing with the Dan sisters, same thing with Raymond, same thing with our case, and very much the same thing with Cliven. Everybody claims that you have to have a grazing permit legally to run cattle out here. Now, my stepmother was a former member of Congress, and she publicly put out a statement saying that if anybody could show her anywhere in the law you were required to have a grazing permit, she would pay that person $1,000. And she never paid that $1,000.
Would that be the same situation as the Bundys again?
Yeah, and well, the problem with the grazing permit is this, it's what the government, the federal agencies have done with the grazing permit that is problematic. Over the years, on our ranch, our predecessors in interest, all who could prove that they had pre-existing rights to be on that range, in other words, they'd been grazing there historically, they had the vested water rights, the forage rights, the roads, the fences, the pipelines, the water developments, and so forth. When they could prove that, and the Forest Service was the first agency to implement a grazing permit system, if they could prove that, then they were granted a grazing permit. And in that instance, we had Tim Hooper ended up with one of those grazing permits. I believe he's one of Raymond's relatives distantly, or as we discussed earlier, but he was a Western Shoshone Indian down in our part of the country. He had a grazing permit, as did all of the other subsequent white settlers that came into that country that ended up with a grazing permit. Well, back in those days, a grazing permit was one page. It quantified the number of cattle, it quantified the season of use, and it said, if I remember correctly, they had to put some salt out. And so the Forest Service did manage numbers, they did manage seasons of use, but that was about it. By the time my dad signed a grazing permit in 1978, that grazing permit was 3 or 4 or 5 pages thick. It had an annual operating plan, and they had so many terms and conditions in those grazing permits, and then they added them as they went during the course of the year with these petty so-called violations, such as putting a staple in a fence, that they used the terms and the conditions of the grazing permit to break the rancher. And that was my dad's complaint. That was, in essence, that was Raymond's complaint. That was the Dan sisters' complaint. In other words, they were being broke anyway. But we all, in our own way, claimed a pre-existing right to be there. And, of course, Raymond's claim is much better than our claim. He's got ancestral rights going clear back to whenever the Western Shoshones ended up out here. The same with the Dan sisters. And we in our ranch had rights going back to 1866. Cliven Bundy has rights going back to somewhere in the 1870s, I understand. So it was these pre-existing rights that we were saying in our case that we were paying property taxes on them. We're going to pay, whenever our state is settled, we're going to be paying estate taxes on those rights. Yet the government denied us the ability to avail of our property rights. We basically had a ranch that was a white elephant. My dad was paying the taxes on it. He was paying to keep it improved, but he couldn't run cattle. And finally, in his case with my brother, they decided to kick cattle out, very much like Raymond did and the Dan sisters did, to stand on those property rights. And ultimately, we prevailed in that, at least at the lower court level, and we had a court rule that we needed our rights restored to their original numbers, and he found the government to have conspired to take our vested rights and our range improvements. He found evidence of racketeering or RICO. He found evidence of fraud, mail fraud and wire fraud. He held two guys in contempt of court, the Forest Service District Ranger and the BLM manager. And I'm here to tell you the same things he found in our case, he can probably find a judge, if they had it properly brought before them, could probably find in Cliven's case. And so what we're seeing is a long-standing conspiracy on the part of these federal agencies to run the Western rancher out of business and to forcibly take vested water rights and forage rights and improvements without compensation.
Those aren't just your words. We'll have a link to an article that links back to what the judge actually said And he was outraged. I think that's a quote. Can you touch
on
that real quick?
He said he used specific language. It's very important. He said the conduct of the federal employees was shocking to the conscience of the court. And that is a finding of the court that is necessary to file a Bivens complaint against public employees personally. And that's where the public employee under law has stepped outside of their lawful delegated authority. And once they do that, then they are no longer protected by the immunities of being a government employee, and they can be sued personally. And so that is something that we're looking into pursuing.
We've got 4 minutes left now. I'm sorry Sheriff Mack isn't here to talk about it. Again, he and the CSPOA, they basically tried to get the sheriff to do his job. whether or not that actually happened, I don't know, but it's an interesting coincidence that the sheriff stepped out and announced that BLM was standing down. We'll have a link to Nevada law that shows that the people that are out there being called terrorists and armed militia, they can be legally deputized. That's called the power of the county. These people are within the law. It's just the law isn't upholding. The law is not being upheld.
Well, I'd like to interject there. This is really the story of two sheriffs. Because we had Sheriff Gillespie, who had, like I said, all these resources at his disposal, and somehow or another didn't think he was capable of keeping the peace. Yet in the neighboring county just to the north, Nye County, third largest county in the United States, massive areas of federally managed lands, and the federal government, BLM, came in and told him, in our case, that they needed to come confiscate our cattle. And he didn't understand the issues quite at first. He was from New Jersey. He wasn't used to these Western issues. But he studied up on them, and he basically discovered that on federal managed lands, such as the BLM managed lands and the Forest Service managed lands, that the government holds those lands only in a proprietorial interest only jurisdiction, meaning they hold those lands like any other landowner. And as I said, Congress reserved in every land law passed by Congress civil and criminal jurisdiction or police power to the states. So once he got a hold of that, he basically told the sheriff, or told the BLM, he said, no, I don't think you have the proper authority. And he said, I'll tell you what, and I'm paraphrasing, he said, if you come in here with a real court order, not just a signed piece of paper from a government bureaucrat, and he said, then I will run the law enforcement operation and we'll impound the cattle that way. Well, they didn't like that answer, so they threatened to arrest him. So Sheriff DeMeo gave him his home address and told him he'd be there and they could come and get him. And a little while later, the BLM came back to him and said, well, we realize maybe the BLM doesn't have the authority to run a law enforcement action. And again, I think we need a congressional investigation as to where they're getting their guns and the appropriation for law enforcement. But anyway, he asked the question. They said this time, they said, we've got Park Service law enforcement officers that we know have the authority to have police powers. And so Sheriff DeMeo at first was uncertain about that because he thought, yeah, they do have police powers. Well, what it is the National Park Service police are on the same level as the police in the District of Columbia in Washington, D.C. And, yes, they do have police powers in a federal enclave under Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 for forts, docks, and needful buildings and so forth in the District of Columbia.
One minute left.
The only place in Nye County that's a federal enclave. Now, mind you, Nye County is the home of Area 51. Nye County is the home of all the above ground and underground nuclear testing and a big military base. The only federal enclave in Nye County is the Tonopah Post Office. And so once the sheriff became aware of that and became aware of the land jurisdiction of these federally managed lands, then he told the BLM, they said they're going to bring in a SWAT team, and he said, that's fine, I'll meet you with my SWAT team. Now, mind you, he did not have Sheriff Gillespie's SWAT team. He just had Podunk Nye County SWAT team to meet them with, but he stood up and did his job.
But he could have had deputies just exactly like the Bundy Ranch if they were deputized. And the sheriff is breaking the law, according to Nevada law, that we'll post it. The people can be their own judge. We're
well,
out of time,
you know,
guys. Go ahead. Finish that thought, if you would.
Oh, I think in some cases I wish tarring and feathering was still legal.
It's been
Sheriff Gillespie very, very nearly had blood on his hands.
Yes, but that's the good news to all of this is there was no blood. This was not bunker.
Thank
here.
God.
Amen. Guys, I really thank you for standing. I wish Sheriff Mack was here to also say thank you again. I couldn't put this show together without him, and there would have been blood two Saturdays ago. There's no doubt in my mind. I knew what he was going to do before he went in there, and he sent in people to try to get this sheriff to do what he needed to do. The Constitution still works, and that's the real news story here. Thanks for joining us, y'all, and until next week, stay tuned. Bye-bye.